Hey, this is Mike Klassen, and welcome to Vancouver Overcast, a podcast where we have conversations with city leaders and innovators. My guest on this episode is Peter Meisner, a digital strategist who audiences will know from his previous on-air work with Global TV. Peter is a passionate urbanist and publisher of Urban YVR, a popular architecture website that showcases new housing, office, commercial, and industrial developments in Metro Vancouver. You can also find features about public art, park space, and transit stations. You could spend hours at urbanyvr.com just browsing the hundreds of new buildings, plazas, and picturesque designs that are reshaping the fabric and the economy of our metropolitan area. Peter is a resident of Vancouver's downtown core, who has lived in the Gastown and Yaletown neighborhoods. On social media, you can see Peter engaging in lively conversations on issues facing our region and the impact on downtown residents in particular. In his spare time, Peter is also the vice chair of the Gastown Historic Area Planning Committee. I look forward to hearing his informed perspectives on life in our city and what lays ahead for the development sector. And now, it's time for Vancouver Overcast. Very pleased to have Peter Meisner on the Vancouver Overcast podcast today. Peter, welcome. Before we get into our more wide-ranging discussion, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where do you hail from, and you know, how did you arrive at where you are today?
Yeah, happy to be here, Mike, and thanks for the opportunity. Hail from Nanaimo, the harbor city on Vancouver Island. Grew up there and moved to Vancouver right after high school. To pursue my dream of journalism. So I applied to the BCIT Broadcast Journalism Program, and that was a dream of mine. I used to do the announcements in high school and also had wrote for the school newspaper, even wrote, you know, a newspaper in the neighborhood as a teenager. So these are some of the things I was doing as a teenager for fun, which may seem kind of unusual, but I think a lot of people that are journalists could probably relate to that. You know, moved to Vancouver, got into the program, and then started my career first in online media. So as an online news producer for Canada.com. And that took me to Winnipeg for 4 years, where I got my first job at CanWest News Service, now Post Media, and came back to Vancouver in 2008 and started working at Global BC. So I was their first online news producer. And that was a time when Twitter and Facebook and all those things were coming up, and they were just looking for somebody to help them get online, maintain their website, train their anchors on how to use social media, fix the printer, troubleshoot the Wi-Fi. Like, I ended up being the tech person there as well in a certain way. But that's a little bit about where I come from and when I came back to Vancouver and where my story starts back here.
And of course, you and I met back then when you were at Global, and I was coming in for What's the Deal or whatever the name of that show on BC One, which obviously was a new channel.
BC One.
And so I got to kind of test out my pundit chops back then. Just kind of thinking about the here and now right now, obviously, we're still in the throes of a pandemic. Just can you tell me a little bit about how the pandemic has affected you personally, or either you personally or your work?
Yeah, it's been challenging for sure. I feel very fortunate to have been working throughout the entire pandemic, having it affect my employment. I have several friends that lost their jobs, unfortunately. In the service industry, and I just feel very fortunate that I've been employed the entire time. Working from home since March, like many office people who worked in offices, been a big adjustment. Obviously has some perks. No commute. I can make lunch for myself every day. I can go for a walk downtown if I have time. I'm fitter than I was before the pandemic, believe it or not. It's been an adjustment from a mental health perspective. I think it's been challenging as well. When you're not interacting with people, every day in a social environment, social get a lot of energy from interacting with people, and it's just not the same online. So, but I do feel that I've adjusted pretty well, and I am looking forward to going back to the office eventually, probably later this year.
I know we all have our bubbles. I've got, you know, my wife and my daughter here at home. I sort of see my mom. I see my in-laws. How big's your bubble these days?
There's a few people in my bubble. I live alone. So it's challenging as well during the pandemic being, you know, I am used to living alone. It's been probably 5 years or so since I've lived with somebody, but got a few close friends in my bubble and do a lot of outdoor things with them. So actually later today, I'm going to a birthday picnic, which is now allowed because of the change to the provincial health orders. So I'm very happy about that. And of course, I keep in touch with family and friends on WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Like, I'm very connected. If anything, I have to remind myself sometimes to put my phone down and not be so connected.
Yeah, no, I know that feeling at all. So as somebody who has personally put a lot of sweat into a web property, in my case, it was citycaucus.com for a few years, I think I can relate to the amount of work that has gone into urbanyvr.com. So tell me how the site came about and what made it motivate you to keep it going.
Yeah, so I've always been interested in urban development, civic politics as well, but just issues facing the city. Architecture has always been a passion of mine. I actually really wanted to be an architect as well as a journalist, but I was terrible at math. So I didn't pursue that and pursued my other passion, which was journalism. But when I was at Global News, I often pitched stories that affect people downtown, whether they were issues happening in the neighborhood or new developments, new plazas, parks, buildings. I remember pitching the story about Vancouver House when that was like in development, in the planning stages, as a story that I thought that we should cover. At that time, Global News wasn't, and a lot of newsrooms, they weren't really covering those issues as much. And every time we did those stories, we got a lot of great viewer feedback. So when I left Global in 2015, I really wanted to continue to report on those urban issues. And that's why I started the website, UrbanYVR.
So since you began the website, which was what year?
2015. Yeah.
2015.
Or was it 2016? Sorry, 2016.
So it's been going on almost about 5 years now. So since you began
that's
the
right.
website,
yeah, that's right.
Tell me two things that you can think that have changed the most about development in Metro Vancouver, just in the past.
The explosive growth in the suburbs is astounding to me. When I worked at Global, as you know, it's in Burnaby. And I remember going to Brentwood, well, and also driving past it every night on my way home. And it was nothing like it is today. I mean, it's unbelievable out there. There's a ton of towers. And I actually can't even, it's difficult to keep track of all of them, but it's a lot, it's easier to build there, right? The process for approving building permits is way faster, way easier. There's less red tape.
The land is cheaper.
So I think that's probably one of the biggest transformations in the Lower Mainland, as well as the Cambie Corridor. It's unrecognizable as well. And in terms of downtown, a lot of a shift to, I would say, luxury product exclusively. There's very little housing that's being built downtown now that's not extremely high-end housing. So, those days of being able to buy a condo and, just a regular condo tower downtown for your average person, unfortunately, are gone. Everything that's being built is, in my opinion, totally out of reach of most working people in Vancouver. And that's really changed in the past 5 years. So those are probably the biggest transformations in terms of development that I've seen. And also the Starkitects, these buildings by these internationally renowned architects. It seems like every time I hear about a new building proposal downtown, well, there's some big name attached to it. And that's something that we didn't see 10 years ago, even 5 years ago.
Do you feel like, just kind of staying on this topic, do you feel as the publisher of a website that probably looks not neutrally, but fairly favorably at the development industry, that you are in a position to comment what you're seeing? I mean, obviously with the journalism background, you try to take as clear sight on a subject as possible. But, you know, as you've grown into a publisher and somebody who is very present on social media, you're not shy about your opinions, and you're kind of telling me what I'm hearing is we're developing luxury product downtown. We're not building housing that people from your generation are going to be able to afford. I think I take that away from what you just said.
Yep, that is true. And it's a shame, in my opinion. I think that there's a lot of policies that have been enacted over the past decade or so that have resulted in this, whether that's some of the rezoning that's been done in the West End that has created these incredible, well, not incredible, but ridiculous land valuations, that the only thing that can be built, housing in order to recover those land costs. And that is, I think, has backfired, to be honest with you. I cover the development and architecture, well, development industry and architecture, but I'm not working for them. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm a journalist. I'm interested in it. I'm trying to approach things very neutrally, but I have lots of opinions as somebody who's young and, you know, came here to the Lower Mainland, like really with nothing, took out student loans, worked my way, worked hard to, you know, establish myself here. And I look to some of my friends that are younger than I am, and it's going to be really difficult for them to build a life here. They don't necessarily see a future here where they could own even a condo. I'm not sure what they're going to do. And I'm not sure what, I feel like the city, it's not a big enough priority for them to figure out, you know, we need to provide housing for people that are actually working here and not just social housing and then high-end product. There needs to be, you know, housing for the average middle income earner. And that's just not, it's not happening. And I understand, the economics of it, that obviously if you pay $250 million for a piece of property, like the white spot in Georgia, how are you going to provide affordable housing? I mean, it just doesn't, the numbers don't make sense, but the reason that those properties are valued like that is because of city policies that have been enacted to allow extremely tall buildings, for example, expectations about really high CACs. I heard about a project the other day on West Georgia that's going to have a $29 million CAC to the city, the community amenity contribution. Well, that's like, you know, I think there's 150 units in that building. So divide that $29 million by 150 plus all the other costs, and this all gets passed on to the consumer. Plus rental housing, like we're not building enough rental housing downtown. And the rental housing that we are building is high end. It's only really affordable to people that are making close to $100,000 a year. So where are we expecting people to live and go? I don't think we're doing enough. And it's the city, but it's also industry. There's no simple solution. I don't know what the answer is, but it needs a rethink. And I just don't see it as a priority for the city, to be honest with you. I think they're expecting people to live in smaller and smaller and smaller spaces, commute from the suburbs, move to the River District, for example, that sort of thing.
One of the hats I wear is that I have been on the board for PAL Vancouver, which is basically in the shadow of that white spot site. It's down on Cordero in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And it's astonishing to think that housing that went in there and began was essentially opened around 2006, was built on city land and would be virtually inconceivable in that part of the city today. I mean, even with free land, that kind of housing, we're doing another development in New Westminster. I'm not sure if it's been featured on Urban YVR yet, but there is a tower and another building, a 9-story building, I believe, that we're building in downtown New Westminster that I'm very excited about. And did a lot of work to make that happen. It's a partnership with the province. But you know, you mentioned the fact that we're sort of building this high end product, and then we're funding a lot of social housing. There was a discussion that you weighed into just recently about a controversial social housing proposal for Granville Street in downtown South. Can you give me your sort of thoughts about the proposal and what concerns you would have had around it?
Mm-hmm. So I think there's a couple concerns there. Granville Street is really our only entertainment district. That's an exclusive street that is meant to be the city's entertainment district, where there can be bars, people in the street. And you know, Vancouver doesn't have amazing nightlife. Let's be honest with it. Let's be honest about it. I mean, Vancouver's not known for its amazing nightlife, and we have Granville Street, and that is, you know, a center of nightlife and arts entertainment. And I just don't think that housing on Granville Street is necessarily compatible with what Granville Street is intended to be, and that is the entertainment district. And the Downtown Vancouver Business Improvement Association has done a lot of work to develop a vision for Granville Street in terms of encouraging more restaurants, more entertainment venues, perhaps patios, that sort of thing. And it just runs counter the city's intentions to essentially rezone part of Granville Street to encourage the development of social housing. It really runs counter to the Downtown Vancouver BIA's vision for the street. And I don't understand why the city is not taking the advice of the BIA. Like, the BIA is the expert on Granville Street, but the city has other ideas about what they think should be happening. And also, I think that if we're going to be concentrating, you know, large areas of supportive housing in one area, I don't think is necessarily a great idea. I mean, we just have to look at what the situation is in the downtown east side and what happens when you have supportive housing concentrated in one area and nothing else. It's not good for anybody. It's not good for the people that live there. It's not good for the city, for the fabric of the city. And I believe in creating more mixed neighborhoods. So I have concerns about what the city's plans are to once again place all this social housing in this small area. And on top of that, the issue that I was just chatting about Granville Street, that it's the entertainment district, right? You know, these social housing sites that the city is identifying as possible sites for social housing on Granville Street are right across from the Yale Saloon, the Morrissey. Like, this is still part of the entertainment district. So it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. And I just wonder why. And on top of that, I think that the rollout of the Howard Johnson Hotel purchased by the province as supportive housing was very difficult for the neighborhood. I don't think there was no consultation, obviously. It was just purchased and people were placed there. And I think it's been really challenging for the neighborhood. I feel that a lot of the residents that are living there don't necessarily have the supports that they need to be successful living in that environment. There's been a dramatic change in the neighborhood. And I'm not saying that it's just because of that building, but the way that was handled and rolled out, I think was less than ideal. So I wonder what the plans are for these social housing sites. I think we have reason to be concerned about what's planned because we don't know what the plan is.
Yeah, you did sort of ask the question, you know, you wonder what the motivation was to go in that particular area, but I'm sure the city has its own justification. And I know there's been some pushback. I saw some housing advocates on Twitter that were of the view that, you know, we've got to take any opportunity we can to find more social housing. So I appreciate the fact that you're at least weighing into the issue. I think a lot of people, many people are just kind of throwing up their hands in frustration. And as you mentioned, many people your age, and I'm not trying to sort of put you into a box of just because of your age, but let's face it, getting your feet on the ground, in terms of career, starting a family, or even owning or being able to afford housing in Vancouver. All of those things are important choices, and they're really difficult choices these days. So I want to talk a little bit about life in downtown Vancouver in general. I saw your tweet about the little mini encampment that took place in front of the mayor's condo tower. It provoked a story on Global News.
Yes.
You know, again, I'm not trying to pick on the mayor here, but it does seem like that there isn't a consistent standard in what we expect of it. But let's focus, instead of talking about that one incident, just tell us about your view of living in the downtown core right now, or downtown in the Yale Town neighborhood.
Yeah, across the library. So just on the border.
Just on the border there. Yeah. And so what do you like? Let's start with maybe to say, what do you like about living in the downtown?
I mean, I love living downtown. I always wanted to live downtown. When I was growing up and we would go on school field trips to Science World, or we'd drive out to see family in the Fraser Valley, we would sometimes drive through downtown and I would look up at the buildings and think like, oh, I want to live there one day. But I mean, what I love about downtown is, you know, same thing that a lot of people love is you can go out your door and walk everywhere. You can walk to a coffee shop, you can walk to get groceries, you can walk and sit in the park, which I was doing this morning with a coffee. And it's dynamic, and there's always people around. I also think that the urban environment downtown is beautiful. You know, I think there's great examples of planning and beautiful streets and beautiful buildings. I find it very energizing, living downtown. But sorry, what was the second part of your question?
I think I did want to hear, and you've done a great job of describing why you like living downtown. And I suppose the flip side of that, the flip side of that question is, what would you change about where your community right now if you had the power to do that?
Yeah, okay. I think that we have a reluctance in Vancouver to make big, bold, exciting placemaking decisions. The plaza in front of the art gallery is a perfect example. And I'm talking about the Robson Street portion. So that's been under construction for, I don't know, 2 to 3 years now. And it's just one block of, you know, closing the street to make a plaza, which I think is a great idea. And I think it's going to be amazing when it's open. But just the fact that it's taken that long to create that one block of a pedestrian friendly, you know, plaza is ridiculous. I mean, I was in Montreal last summer when we could, you know, take a bit of a travel break with COVID-19, of course. But St. Catherine Street in Montreal, they've done what they've done in front of the art gallery for probably 10 blocks, maybe 15 blocks. And when I was there, they were building more and more blocks that were car-free, pedestrian-friendly, similar kind of design in terms of the quality of the urban environment. And everything in Vancouver takes forever. Like, I understand that there has to be consultation, but we need to think really big about what kind of city we want to create. And I feel that we're just falling behind. There hasn't been a lot of city making, place making initiatives in the city. And I feel that, you know, COVID-19 was a really great time for us to reflect on what we really want in our downtown core. And there's just been a huge reluctance to even allow, you know, restaurants to have patios, for example, to close off portions of streets, to create more outdoor dining space. We need to think, Vancouver is a global city. We have a huge opportunity here. We have, you know, big things happening. There's a lot of office development underway. There's going to be thousands of workers that are going to be working downtown, say at the post office, for example. We need somebody with vision. We need, and I'm not trying to pick on the mayor, but we need a leader with vision who is not afraid to make things happen. And I just don't think we have that right now. And everything seems involved, and we've got to think bigger.
Since we're talking about where how slowly and your sounds like your frustration with how Vancouver is moving forward or its inability to really do that. Which municipality in Metro Vancouver you think is charting the course for development and economic growth that impresses you most?
I think City of North Vancouver is very impressive. I look at what they've done with their development down at Lonsdale Quay. I was just there a few days ago. It's fantastic. It's pedestrian friendly. It's high quality. It has a lot of public amenities. It's not just condos on the water. There's a large area for children to play. There's restaurants. It's very well integrated. And when you drive down Lonsdale, there's a lot of patios. They were one of the first municipalities to really allow restaurants to create curbside patios during the COVID-19 pandemic. It seemed to happen really, really quickly. I think in Burnaby, some of the master planning that's happening in terms of the Brentwood neighborhood, the Lougheed neighborhood, the Metrotown neighborhood is really impressive and gives us a lot of certainty to developers of housing that they know what they can build. It's not like Vancouver where it's spot rezonings all over the place and it takes forever for housing to get through the process because, you know, people like to hate on developers, but developers are providing housing for us and we have a housing shortage, a housing crisis. So by making it more difficult for them to provide that housing, it's increasing the cost for everybody. But those are two cities where I see really great urban environments being created, as well as Victoria. I think Victoria is doing a fantastic job following in Vancouver's footsteps with encouraging bike lanes and that sort of thing that are well integrated into the streets and not impeding the flow of traffic. And also the scale of the city in Victoria. They have not necessarily huge 60-story towers, but they have more human scale development that's very high quality and well integrated into the urban environment. So those are some places that stand out to me around the Lower Mainland anyways and on the island.
You mentioned the master planning happening around Brentwood is one example of the Burnaby neighborhood. I work in the Metrotown area. I kind of despair in some ways of the great towers that are going up that are 45 or 55 stories like they are in Brentwood, but nothing to really together on the ground. I'm really worried. And I was very critical of Kennedy Stewart. In fact, I was the only person who wrote, to my knowledge, an actual mainstream published article that ran in Burnaby Now, Vancouver Courier, that said, as member of parliament for Burnaby South, he did virtually nothing to deal with the raising of affordable housing that elderly and racialized people, very, very affordable housing there, as Mayor Corrigan, the previous mayor, saw fit to kind of move forward and not replace any of it with any affordable housing. And that was super frustrating to me. And he took a few punches at me in some of his comments afterwards. But I think it was fair game. Mm-hmm. But again, not to focus on him, you mentioned the master planning. I am hopeful that they're able to turn those places that are really a lot of big building sites the last few years into real neighborhoods. And so I look forward to that master planning process. I have to say at this point, skeptical. I'm still waiting for there to be energy on the ground where families and communities can come, like I see in some of the neighborhoods that we have in Vancouver. So,
Mike, I was just going to mention that, you know, one of the great things that Burnaby is doing now is they are requiring the one-for-one replacement of those of the rental housing that was demolished for those newer developments. So that's fantastic. I mean, that's something that Vancouver should be doing. And that was because of the new mayor, Mayor Hurley in Burnaby. And yeah, that should have happened 5 to 10 years ago. I totally agree with you. But thankfully it's happening now. I think it's a great example for municipalities to follow because developers are still building there. You know, it still makes financial sense for them. And the people that were living in those smaller walk-up apartments are getting the chance to move into these new places at, I believe it's at similar rates to what they were paying in the buildings that were demolished. So that's a great example of redevelopment that's sensitive to the existing residents, which is, of course, important.
Actually, I remember when the city of Vancouver put a one-for-one rental in. So if they lost rental, they had to sit with another unit. Now, they were not equitable in any way. Usually you would get maybe a $400 or $500, you know, 2.5-bedroom rental, and then you would probably get, you know, a studio for $1,800 after that is considered to be a replacement.
Exactly.
Sadly, but that policy was originally put in 2007. I think it was, it was the MPA council of the day. And then there were things like the STIR program. I actually was on the city planning commission for in 2007 and 2008, where Dr. Seti Pendekar and the rest of the commissioners came up with a kind of a plan that talked about using bonus density to try and create rental. And then that turned into a bunch of different programs that the Vision Council brought in. But again, we have really failed to kind of meet that test of providing that housing for that middle and finding affordable rental. And I worry that there's no turning back now. The land values being what they are. I know that Colleen Hardwick, the city councilor, has been quite vocal about what she sees as, and it echoes a little bit what you were saying. I mean, she's obviously taken a pretty strong viewpoint about against large development generally in her vote. But she also talks about how some of those developments are contorting the market, are driving up land prices. And so, again, it's, you're dancing on a bit of a head of a pin right now to try and decide whether you want to have more housing or if you want to have something that's sustainable and affordable. And so I suppose that's probably one of the more interesting things about somebody doing a site like Urban YVR is that you are really on the taking a front seat to that, taking a look at what's happening right now. I want to just maybe talk about one other topic that you like to showcase on the site is about public art. This is an area that I sometimes sound off about. There's a recent piece that was just brought in down by the water in Yale Town at the end of Drake Street. Sometimes the Biennale pieces, I think, are sometimes really lovely, and I just wish they would stay. But what's your take on public art, particularly in Vancouver?
I think we need more public art, for sure. And for sure. I know the piece that you're talking about with the man kind of hunched over. I tweeted about it, joking that that's how I feel if I try to run again, because I used to run a long time ago and trying to get back in, not enjoying it. But I think, you know, the Biennale pieces are fantastic. I hear what you're saying about wanting some of them to stay that you really like, but I think it's also great that they change all the time. Keeps things dynamic and interesting. I was just also chandelier today, which is probably the chandelier under the Granville Street Bridge, probably one of the most controversial pieces of public art in the city. But you know, tons of people were taking video of it and talking about it, and you know, it's art. Art is subjective, right? Not everybody's going to like every piece of art. I would like to see more public art, but of the Biennale variety, actually, because it changes. I find it keeps, the city's always changing, the city's dynamic. So I like to see art that's dynamic as well.
The Biennale pieces that were showcased during the Olympics were some of my favorite. One that was actually in the city of Richmond, Miss Mao, which was super controversial, probably made a lot of people who in that community a little frustrated, but I thought it was a fabulous piece. A big head of Lenin with a tiny, I think, Chairman Mao on the top. So at any rate, it was, but it was, and a big shiny chrome finish to it as well. And it was right across the street from, of all places, which makes me wonder why we don't take some of these pieces and put them in our other neighborhoods. So people, they would be attractions in other places around the city. And oh, by the way, just obviously this is a topic that I think about sometimes, the East Vancouver sign. You know that the East Vancouver sign, which I think is a fabulous monument, of course, that came during the Olympics and by a Vancouver artist, is going to now have a big building sitting in front of it.
Yes, Nature's Path headquarters. Read some of the planning minutes around that. I think they're going to try to orient the building so you can still see the sign, I hope. But yeah, it would be very unfortunate if the view of that was blocked because it's very iconic. I mean, I've seen people have it on their t-shirts and all sorts of things. That kind of public art that's permanent of that variety is awesome. Like, I think that that's a really cool kind of icon for the neighborhood. And yeah, love East Van. So lived in East, all over East Van at various points in my life.
So you recently got into an interesting Twitter interaction with Karen Ward, who's an activist who's documented the surge of opioid addiction in downtown Vancouver. I follow her on Twitter. She's very passionate and pretty honest. And she started off by telling you to F off.
That's right. Not the first time.
What was interesting to me is you sort of were able to diffuse the discussion and then you ended up landing on some points of agreement, which is always a rare skill on Twitter. You know, your work on Urban YVR showcases a lot of the new, but where people are struggling with poverty or with opioid addiction, you know, where do those people fit in your view, within our communities?
Well, they're definitely part of our community, no doubt about it. And Karen and I both want to see people in housing that is supportive and dignified. But, you know, I don't think that buying an old rundown hotel to warehouse vulnerable people is the answer. And that, in my opinion, is what happened with Howard Johnson on Granville. And I just have concerns about that for the neighborhood, but most importantly for the people who are living there. These are places that are not necessarily dignified, or they have fire safety issues, they have seismic issues, they're run down. And why are we just writing a check to buy an old rundown building to warehouse vulnerable people in? I mean, I think we've seen over and over again that that is a recipe for disaster. That's why the Balmoral is closed. That's why the Region is closed, right? And I just see us repeating the same mistakes over and over again. And also, I mean, if we want to get serious about building social housing, we got to make it happen. You know, these temporary modular social housing units, yes, they're filling a gap that they can be turned around really quickly, but I think you and I both know that they're going to be there for 5 to 10 years, maybe even longer. So why are we not building more social housing? Why are we not requiring contributions from developers that are building these, again, high-end buildings around the city to fund the development of social housing? You know, it's sad what's happening in the downtown east side. For the people that live there and also for the city, this is not a neighborhood that is functioning well for anybody. And just the pace of what we're doing to try different approaches. Like, we need different approaches. We need to listen to the experts in science, but we got to try different approaches. I mean, I think safe supply is great, and we need safe supply. That's going to save lives.
That's going to save lives for
sure. And Karen and I agree on that. And housing and support and mental health
and mental health support.
I just don't think you can put somebody in a room with no supports and think that's really going to help them.
Yeah. No, I mean, as somebody who's been a student of municipal politics over these last few decades, I remember the biggest, probably boldest collaboration happened between Rich Coleman and the city of Vancouver. Rich was basically the man in charge of the housing file for 11 years, which is the longest I think anybody ever held that. Helped to develop BC Housing, a very, I think, innovative organization in terms of housing and development, and was able to secure quite a few sites around the city of Vancouver, and as well was able to take over the operations of a lot of old buildings in the downtown east side as well. Those kinds of programs require a huge amount of compromise and political cooperation that, to me, that is feels like the missing piece. Now, again, I'm not going to always talk about the mayor, but the mayor has been talking a lot about his interactions with Ottawa, for example. And that's a very important part of it, but everybody has to sort of come to the table. And that's, to me, something that has been, I think, sorely missing for a while, is where people want to get to really make things happen on the housing side. So I'm just going to leave you with one thought. I mean, to share, which is about the pandemic again. When it is over, what's the one thing you can't do now that you put at the top of your to-do list?
Travel, probably. I'm desperate to go somewhere, go somewhere warm. I love traveling to Latin America, so I'm missing Mexico and Brazil and Argentina and those kinds of places. But another thing I'm missing is going out. And, you know, I'm in my late 30s, I'm 38, but, the pace of going out to the bar or club is kind of slowed a lot. And over the past few years, I've admittedly wanted to stay home and watch Netflix and drink wine. But I think when we're allowed to go out again, I'm going to make more of an effort to go out and get on the dance floor and showcase my bad dance moves. So those are like the two things that I'm really looking forward to. Not the only things I'm looking forward to, though. Of course, seeing my family, hugging my Oma, who's in a care home in 95, seeing my coworkers, etc. House parties, missing those for sure.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I for one would be love to see your dance moves. If only we could.
No, you don't.
Just as a change of pace, because this has been a really challenging year. But I want to thank you very much, Peter, for allowing me to talk to you for the first time in a way like this. We've known each other for a few years now, but I mean, I got a sense from your conversations that you've been holding online that you have a few things bottled up that you wanted to talk about, and I was glad that we were able to kind of bring those out. I want to remind our listeners to go check out urbanyvr.com. It's a great site. So much interesting. There's a story there, I think, really of change. The Eye for Design, you mentioned the Starkitects. There are some very positive things that you're documenting there, and there are things that we probably need to maybe ask ourselves whether we are going down the right road. Very much appreciate you coming on the podcast, and look forward to a time when we get to speak again, hopefully in person.
Yes. Thanks so much for having me, Mike. I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks very much. We'll talk to you later.